Chairman Harper and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Sizemore, and I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Taxpayers United, an organization that has been somewhat active in the initiative process from time to time. I actually have a long list, and of things that I think would make the process work better for all sides. And I have genuinely attempted to be concentrate on those things that would make the process better, not just make it better for me. So take it that way. A number of improvements in the process came from Oregon Taxpayers United, such as our current ballot title, where we have the yes vote, no vote, versus the just the old confusing double negative type questions we used to have. That was something we brought before this body, and it was introduced, discussed, debated, refined, and is the process we have today, which is very popular with Oregon voters. They like it a lot better than they did the old process. Didn't help or didn't hurt us particularly. It just made the process better for everyone. I can't help but just in three sentences, I think, comment on some of the suggestions that Senator Metzger brought. Is that Metzger? Is that what it was?
Mm-hmm.
Forgive me. He used to be my senator, but I forgot his name as soon as I moved to another district. The idea of not being able to amend the Constitution on anything but a limited number of ideas. Interesting aspect of that is all those areas of the Constitution that are currently there that don't deal with those ideas will be locked in and cannot be changed, because any amendment to do so would be dealing with something other than the basic structure of government. Even things like the double majority that was an idea that we placed on the ballot and passed. A lot of people, including the governor, don't like it. Majority of Oregon voters did. But any attempt to change that, you could never do it. Because, after all, I don't think that probably doesn't deal with the basic structure of government, the kinds of things that some might suggest. You'd end up in an endless war of subjectivity as to whether something dealt with the basic structure of government or basic rights, and I don't think that it become a very political process. Also, the idea of no reintroducing a measure under the ballot that the voters just rejected. Interesting aspect about that. I just wondered if you'd be willing to extend that to tax measures, bond measures, cereal levies. Voters turn down and they end up back on the ballot in 2 months or 4 months or 8 months. There's four elections per year, eight per two-year election cycle, where governments are allowed to put measures on the ballot, even if they were just rejected in the last election. Hey, if we're going to do that, let's just go ahead and do it. I think if we combine those two, you probably have my support on the idea.
I like that last part. Yeah.
The other one, the ballot title shopping. I know this is a subject that a lot of people in this room, especially those involved in the process through the Secretary of State, the Attorney General's Office, and the Supreme Court, are very interested in. But let me tell you, as a person who has engaged in the activity that they would describe as ballot title shopping, on numerous occasions, because I don't refer to it as that at all. If the measure says substantially the same thing, it will get the substantially the same ballot title. Just because it deals with the same general subject, but does so in an entirely different manner, doesn't make it substantially the same measure. And we ballot title shop, if you will, using the language, the vernacular of those who don't like that process. Because when we find objections to the way a measure is written, we change it substantially enough to get a completely different ballot title. The idea of not having a ballot title until after the signatures have been collected is, it'd be just like you running for election. And right before the election, we do a poll, you do a poll in your district to find out what the voters in your district are concerned about and what they believe in. Wouldn't be much use to you, would it? Because you'd already have done what you've done. A election day is really like a big poll. We just poll everybody all at once. We don't take a scientific sampling. We poll everybody. And we ask them a specific question. But as you know, with your familiarity with polling, the wording of that question is critical to the answer you're going to get. You can change a word in that ballot title and totally change the outcome of the election. Because, and I can't say this more strongly, and in reference to, I think, Senator Byer's comment about maybe they'll stop and read the measures. No, they won't. People don't vote on your measure. They vote on the Attorney General's description of your measure. That's what they have in front of them. I would venture to say that more than 90% will never read the measure they're voting on, just like you probably find it difficult to read all the bills that you will vote on during a session. They won't do it. They'll rely upon the Attorney General's description. And what that description is critical to the vote and the debate that's going to occur on Election Day. So for us to have to circulate a petition, collect the signatures, and then find out months later what the ballot title would be, in a business sense, totally foolish. Not that this is necessarily in any way a business decision. It would be foolish to put all the time and effort into collecting the signatures, whether it's volunteer or paid, and then have the Attorney General describe your measure in a way that has absolutely no chance of passing. I'll give you one example, and more if you ask for it. There was a measure on the ballot, Measure 46, back in 1996. The measure said that, in essence, if a measure to increase taxes appeared on the ballot, that you had to have a majority of registered voters vote yes for it to pass. Not just a majority of those who showed up on Election Day, but a majority of registered voters. Now, I polled that. It wasn't my measure. I polled that and described the measure carefully to voters in the poll. This was a More Information, Bob Moore poll, reputable polling company. And the even gave the example. Let me explain how this works. If you had 75% of the voters show up on Election Day, 2/3 of them would have to vote yes for a tax increase to pass. If 50% of the voters showed up and they unanimously voted yes, the tax measure would fail because you didn't get 50% plus one voting yes. That measure polled 53%. On Election Day, the way that measure was described on the ballot by the Attorney General and the Supreme Court, those people who don't vote in an election count as a no vote. Essentially, just turned the process around. Instead of saying what it took to pass it, he said, if you don't show up to vote, you count as a no vote. That measure got 11% on Election Day, though when described in detail with examples to people, had over half the people said they supported it. But only 11% supported it the way the Attorney General described it. So waiting till you've collected the signature to get your ballot title would be a disservice to those of us who participate in it, whether we are on the left or the right or the middle or what have you. Now, with your patience.
You feel better.
Mr. Chen?
Yes. Yeah, a little bit.
Senator Byer, just a question that Bill, maybe what you're getting at is maybe the number of words, the 35 words, is too few. Maybe we need to expand that so that the Attorney General, in writing the title, can write a description rather than a one-word sentence and go to the cost of having a little bit more paper used in the process so that people, when they're voting, really have a sense of what they're voting on.
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, I'll tell you, we have never really tested the ballot title process we have now through an election cycle. In the last legislative session, you did amend the number of words. It was 15 words. Was all that was allowed for the explanation of a yes vote, 15 words for a no vote. In the last session, you expanded that enough that I think that we probably have sufficient words now. We haven't got a lot of ballot titles that have worked their way through the process now to see if that they more thoroughly explain the measure. The old word limitation was, frankly, so restrictive that the Attorney General wouldn't even use commas, wouldn't even use conjunctions or articles. You won't find a the or an and in one of the old ballot titles. The new process gives enough words and it actually instructs them to please use common everyday conversational language, including conjunctions and articles and normal parts of speech. And hopefully it will be a better process, but it has not yet been tested. I think it's enough now. But we won't know until we've seen enough ballot titles come out of the court.
Carol.
Mr.
Sizemore, do you like ballot titles? Do you think that's something that should stay in?
Actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, in the last session, I asked to have a bill introduced that eliminated ballot titles for measures that were 250 words or less in length. And then when my bill came up for a hearing, I sat up here and testified against it because it's a double-edged sword. I like it. If I could write my measures and they go on the ballot just as they're written and let people decide up or down on the words of the measure. But I can also imagine someone else, or those on the other side, on another side of the debate, writing a ballot title that is very enticing. It would make the writing of your measure, rather than an exercise in accuracy to change some public policy, it would be a marketing tool. You write your measure so that it sounds like you're going to save the environment and make the air cleaner and water purer and save the furry critters and just increase taxes a little bit.
The measure or the ballot title?
The measure. If we had no ballot title and we just put our measures, when we wrote our measures, they would be marketing tools. And I think it is better to have the measure described objectively, analyzed by legal minds, hopefully objectively, and I think that process serves the public better than just putting the measures on the ballot. And some measures are actually quite long.
Well, I guess pursuing the issue, I mean, literally what you're saying, if I understand what you're saying, you're endorsing a ballot title process to, in essence, capture the essence of what a ballot measure is trying to do. And in that sense, you're kind of encapsulating the totality of the speech that's present in the public debate that occurs after that ballot initiative is put forth and title exists. And in essence, you're saying you're going to defer that concise definition of what a speech is going to be discussed to the Attorney General's office, or whoever it is that decides what that measure means. And I guess I'm trying to look at this from a more entrepreneurial, free enterprise, you know, go for it. I've come up with a measure. There is no ballot title. I have to agree that I'm capable of doing it, articulating what I think that ballot title means, and the opposition can themselves go out, raise money, spend their money to articulate what they think the thing means. Keep the Attorney General's office completely out of it, because ultimately what really means anything is the wording of the initiative, the measure that actually passes and becomes part of the law of the Constitution, the Supreme Court, and determines what that is. And right now what we've got is a system that creates, well, we're spending about $114,000, and assuming an election cycle through the Attorney General's office, the Supreme Court is spending an inordinate amount of their time reviewing these issues. And they are not able to docket other cases that I think are substantially important in other areas of law, business law, search and seizure, and other areas that I think are significantly important. It's taken a lot of their time, a lot of their money.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think that last point you made, a lot of talk about the time consumed by the Supreme Court dealing with ballot title cases, a substantial portion of their time, growing portion of their time. I submit to you that that is of their own doing.
Mr. Chairman, in what way?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, take the state of Washington, for example. If you appeal a ballot title up there, it goes to Thurston County Superior Court to be decided within 5 days. In our current process, think about it for a moment. The Supreme Court interprets the wording of law. What does it mean? Constitution or the statute regarding ballot titles actually says today that we have currently, notwithstanding House Bill 2213 that will probably pass and change this in a minor way, you have 5 days after a measure is filed, initiative is submitted to the Secretary of State, the AG has 5 days to draft a ballot title. Then the public has 10 days to comment. Then the Attorney General has 5 days to analyze those comments and certify a ballot title. Then the public, those who commented, have the option of up to 10 days to file an appeal to the Supreme Court of that certified ballot title. So it's rush, 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 rush. 5 days, 10 days, 5 days, 10 days, and now the Supreme Court is instructed under statute to then hear that case and decide it expeditiously, which means to the Supreme Court whatever they choose it to mean, since they are the ones who interpret the meaning of words legally. And it is common for them to take 4 months, 6 months, 3 months, and they may want to testify, and they have a way of calculating that doesn't seem as long as it is, but I'm talking from the time the appeal is made. Commonly, 4 months to 6 months. You understand, after 5 days, 10 days, 5 days, 10 days, 6 months, 4 months does not sound all that expeditious. Why does everybody else rush back there so they can take 4 to 6 months to decide the case? Because they take so long to decide, it has become a commonly used stalling technique where measures sometimes don't make the ballot just because they needed a couple more days or a week or so and they could have made the ballot. You take somebody to the Supreme Court, even if your case is frivolous, you just tie them up for probably a few months. And so the Supreme Court, by taking so long to decide these cases, they have invited opponents to use it as a tactic, tactically, so that in fact we get lots of appeals to the Supreme Court, appeal after appeal. I can tell you, if I write a measure, put my name on it, and it is submitted, you can just go ahead and start preparing a place on the Supreme Court's docket.
Mr. Chairman, Bill, you seem to be making a very logical and rational argument in favor of no ballot tire.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think there are alternatives, including a very simplified process where if there are objections to the certified ballot title that comes out of the Attorney General's office, then the supporters of the measure write their own. The opponents write their own, ship it up either to the Supreme Court or a newly created body of retired judges, justices, and they pick the one that is best. And you know the principle in collective bargaining of last or final best offer? Everybody fights to get to the middle, because if you're extreme, yours is out the window. So we would have the temptation to write, we would have the motivation to write a ballot title that was very fair and accurate, so that ours would be the one picked. That would take the all the time and the work and all out of the process, and also remove that question of separation of powers that the Supreme Court is currently struggling with about them changing ballot titles after they have been certified by the Attorney General and the executive branch officer.
Can you take me through that one again quickly, make sure we have this down?
The idea of the supporters, what we actually have designed such a process on paper that is similar to the way explanatory statements are currently prepared, two yeas, two nays, and one fifth neutral party they pick. And then what we envision that is, if a ballot title could get the support of a majority of those members, including one supporter and one opponent, then that is the ballot title. But if it doesn't get that support, then the solution is that the supporters and the opponents both write their own. We even included a little nuance that a legislative counsel, if they were here, would probably object to, but that legislative counsel draft a third, and that all three or two, whichever, go to this other body of judges, either the Supreme Court or a newly created body of retired judges, and they just pick one of the three. They go unidentified to the court to the judges, so that they don't even know whether it came from supporters or opponents.
So it's on the title committee?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And pick one.
Pick one. Don't change it. That's it. That's the one. It's final. Okay. If I may go on mute.
Keep on going. Yes, please.
Okay. I'm sorry. There's a lot of people here who want to testify, but...
Well, not too long.
Okay. I'll be brief. I believe we have a problem that I would like to see this body appoint a task force or committee to go through and remove some of the obstacles to the initiative process, the more foolish ones that the Secretary of State or Elections Division has placed into the process. They affect the liberals, the conservatives, the moderates, everybody's affected, such as the case of Senator Burdick's gun show background check, where she was having signatures collected because the paper was shiny. If you do a paper, file an initiative, collect signatures on white paper with black ink, normal 20-pound or 60-pound bond, if you didn't get that pre-approved by the Secretary of State's office, because they approved you on light yellow paper, those signatures would be rejected. If you, one of, that amazes me that you, that anyone would consider disenfranchising 20 voters because we did not pre-approve the color of the paper that you used. When in fact they could just say, we pre-approve all pastel colors, 20 pound or better paper. That's what you can use. That would give us tremendous flexibility. You know, if someone takes one of my petitions that I'm printed on light blue paper and they photocopy it on white paper, and I didn't get that pre-approved, those signatures would be rejected. Sounds nuts to me. Another example, I had a petitioner collect about 6,000 signatures for a measure. When he turned it in, down at the bottom where he writes he signs his name, he printed his name so it was clearly legible, and he filled out his address so we knew who he was and where he lived. But on the signature line, in a hurry, as petitioners tend to do, on probably a few hundred, it was actually about 6,000 signatures, he wrote his initial J with a little line and C with a line. A lot of people sign that way. And even though a initial is a legal signature, you can buy a house with it in the state of Oregon, they rejected all 6,000 signatures, would not even count them. They wouldn't even check for validity, even though they knew who the person was, even though we subsequently took them a signed affidavit saying, this is my signature and this I did collect these. The voters who stopped in some mall in front of some store and took the time to consider that question and sign that petition, they got all their names were just thrown out by an action taken by a petitioner that was rejected by the Secretary of State on the most trivial technical grounds. That is not the Secretary of State or the Elections Division trying to make this process work smoothly for the good of the people of Oregon. That is looking for ways to disenfranchise voters or punish cheap petitioners if they don't dot a T or cross an I.
That's an administrative rule of the Secretary's office, as far as you know, or...
Mr. Chair, at the time that was the signatures were collected, it wasn't even an administrative rule. They passed an administrative rule later, after those were signed, and they still rejected them, even though they hadn't passed the rule till later, because they said that's always been our policy, even though it wasn't even in rule. Let's see, crowded ballots, real quickly. Big reaction to 26 measures being on the ballot, notwithstanding that some of you put six or seven of those on yourselves, helped crowd it up a bit. You know, the answer to that's really pretty simple, at least from my perspective. The Constitution currently says that initiatives will be placed on the ballot in general elections or another date appointed by the legislature. So pick another date. November, every November, or November and May primaries. We have 8 election dates in every 2-year election cycle, including the generals and the primaries. 8. But we can only place measures on the ballot on the general. If we would make the process open to primaries and generals, that would divide the number probably in half. Say every November, so they're a year apart, that would probably do the same thing. And people wouldn't be facing 26 measures. Though that is really, frankly, a rarity. It wasn't nearly 100 years since we'd had those kind of 1914, since we'd had that kind of number on the ballot before. But it would make the process a lot easier for the voter to thoughtfully consider the questions we're placing before them if they didn't have to face them all at once. If governments can place their tax proposals on the ballot 8 different dates in a 2-year election cycle, that same availability or some degree of that should be available to those using the initiative process. Quickly, moving on here. 2213 is coming down the pike from the House and giving the Attorney General 5 more days for certified ballot titles. Good idea. They don't have enough time right now for that certified ballot title. We support that bill, testified yesterday in favor of it, but pointed out, again, another obstacle that the Secretary of State, Attorney General placed. You know that if you don't like the ballot title and you want to appeal it to the Supreme Court, one of my opponents did this. You have to notify the Secretary of State within one day of the filing of the appeal. But he made the mistake of mailing his notification to the Secretary of State's office, and it was received here at the Capitol on time. However, the mailroom didn't deliver it up to the Secretary of State's office. So the case was thrown out in the Oregon Supreme Court because the mailroom had the piece of mail, the notice, but failed to deliver it to the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State says, hey, I didn't receive it on time, even though it was a technicality, even though it was in the mailroom, you're out. How does that make sense? Didn't it substantially affect the question of the debate that the court was going to decide anyway? Some technical stuff that just seems to be like, if we can find you in any possible way breaking any little rule, we're going to nail you. And it happens to my friends, it happens to my foes. I think I've covered the majority of my major points. But I know the ballot title process is one that there's a lot of interest in here. That's one that we think is much more complicated than you realize at first glance. Senator Menas has asked questions that we've asked as well. Why even have them? But I think they do serve, and I'm a person who'd rather write my own ballot title than have the Attorney General write it. But I know my opponents would get to write their own. And we could all make our measures sound a lot better if we wrote our own ballot titles. I think the objectivity of a supposedly neutral party writing that ballot title would be helpful. But there are some improvements we can make into the process and the way that it's done.
Good. Do you have these written down? And what I'm looking for is just bullet statements of these concepts, so we're sure we capture them and we can flesh them out as we go. Is that something you?
Yes, I do, Senator.
And Patty and Phil, maybe if you guys could, the stuff that you brought up, just to make sure that we don't lose something in translation, would that be okay? Yeah, just bullet statements so we know where we are. Is that all right? Okay?
I'd be happy to.
And we've got the tape. Yeah, we've got everything, but just be helpful. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Greg Wasson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Wasson, and I am the founder and executive director of the Committee for Petition Rights. So far, I am the Committee for Petition Rights.
Well, you make decisions.
So I got to appoint myself, and that was not.
Sounds like somebody else would.
I have, for whatever reason, decided that the reason I was born was to save the initiative and referendum process in Oregon. And as sort of an apology or explanation for what follows, I've never been a member of a representative legislature, and so I don't really totally understand all the pressures that you're under. But Lloyd Aston established long ago that absolute power corrupts absolutely. My training, both formal and informal, has convinced me that a centralized authority once created strives to become absolute. By definition, then, a centralized authority strives toward corruption. And that's got nothing to do with the people involved. It's like fuzz on peaches. That's just how it works. Members of the legislature, the state bar, the state bench, have forgotten how to spell initiative and referendum. William S. Wren, who was the father of the initiative process in Oregon, wanted to establish a radical tax scheme that he knew he could never get through the legislature, and that's why he worked to establish the initiative and referendum, so that he would have a legislative body that he could take his tax plan to. In 1909, the people, or 1910, the people removed the power of the legislature to levy taxes without a vote of the people. There were legislators at that time who said, why even have a legislature? Let's just do it by the initiative and referendum process. I think that to try to the initiative process without truly understanding the history of it is just absurd. Senator Metzger talked about the problem with paid petitioners. They paid for petitioners from 1902 to 1932. For 30 years they paid for petitioners. And so this idea that it's a new problem, that's absurd. That's how it's always been. Under the original initiative amendment, the petitioners did write their own ballot titles. And so that has happened. In terms of expense to the AG and the Secretary of State's office, I guess I would say, what better way can the AG and the Secretary of State spend their time than working on what the people of Oregon want to accomplish? I think that's a completely absurd argument. For every problem with the initiative process, I can point to, and you can probably point much better than I, to that same problem in the legislative process. I was an intervener. I intervened in the Flanagan case, the ballot title case, that was mentioned by the Attorney General, and the other side has filed a brief. I got it in the mail a couple of days ago. The President Supreme Court doesn't like the initiative process.
We're just kind of looking for suggestions, if you might have some suggestions for us.
Well, I think that...
improvement suggestions.
Well, first of all, the problem with the ballot title is that this 2-year limit is sticking in the way. But the 2-year limit isn't in the Constitution. It's not even in the statute. It's in an Attorney General's opinion. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that if I don't submit my signatures by July, I can't continue to collect and go on the next election. There's nothing in the Constitution that limits initiatives to every other November. Robert White Thornton just made that up one day, and Tom McCall said, sounds like a good idea to me. And so I guess my suggestion is that that there needs to be some sort of Congress or committee set up to revamp the initiative process. Because the representative government has been attacking the initiative process since before it was established. And so I guess if this legislature did anything, I think the legislature should refer a constitutional amendment that said changes in the initiative process were exempt from the single subject rule, and establish a Congress to combine the many, many sections of the Constitution that conflict with each other and redesign the system. In AA, they taught me that one reason of it, or one definition of insanity, is you keep doing the same thing, expecting different results. And every idea that has come out of this body in the last 10 years has been tried before. And well, I made a terrible presentation, and I'm sorry, but I guess that'd be it.
We appreciate you coming. Thank you very much. Don McIntyre.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate being here. It's a way smaller committee than when we started out today. I was kind of in the dark about what the discussion would be, except I saw that it was possible reforms to the initiative process. And, of course, that that gets a populace like me got my attention, and I see that most of the day has been devoted to the ballot title crisis, and I think I have a perspective on that, too. If we're going to focus on that today, I would like to.
We're not focusing really on anything, Don.
Well, there's one of the things that I would like to say that didn't come up, and we talked about ballot title shopping. Bill said he didn't do that exactly. Well, he has done that exactly, or from time to time. There have been other times when he's modified a measure to get an improvement in it. The real story, though, is and I couldn't help but grind my teeth when I heard the person from the Attorney General's office, is that those people within that department have enjoyed giving petitioners loaded, lousy ballot titles. I mean, you don't need too much explanation of that for me. I mean, that's historic. There have been times I've had an image of the people in the Attorney General's office. Are they the Cats and Jammer kids? Are they the hot shots from Clockwork Orange? They're sitting there enjoying screwing you on the construction of ballot titles, and they know the process it takes. And Bill explained it very well about the powerful impact of a ballot title. And if you don't get the right one, you have to shop it, or you're going to get stuck going through that whole process. Now, there have been some discussions on how to fix that. I agree that I think that since the Constitution doesn't require a ballot title, but they're probably a good idea, I do not know why within a statutory framework we could not allow the chief petitioner to write the ballot title as long as they followed the rules. I like the suggestion that you might have ballot titles from a couple of other sources, and if the chief petitioner wrote a lousy ballot title, it should be adjudicated quickly, and I don't even know that you'd need another body. You could use a local circuit court with a timeline and just say that the chief petitioner has a choice of having a judge or a jury decide it within 5 days, and if it doesn't come out, then tough. Go back and maybe modify the measure. But Bill Sizemore is right in saying that if you have everybody's going to want to try to run toward the middle because you want your title to prevail. So if the rules just say that it needs to be objective and clear, then let the chief petitioner do it. I got to tell you, it will absolutely cut down on the amount of measures filed and save the Attorney General's office a whole bunch of money. I would like to cut them out of the loop, too. And the Supreme Court does not have to waste its time on this. So that's that subject. But if there are going to be reforms to the initiative process, one of the things that I beg you to do, to think about, is that everything that we've seen come out of this body, which, by the way, when it's been referred to the voters, they've rejected it. We've had recent experience with that. That don't just think reform is necessary to further impede the initiative process. And this is where I think we all ought to reflect on, and it's the very first part of our Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, that says all power is inherent in the people. That's a very strong bit of language there, and in fact, it's amplified by saying that the people have the right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in any manner they think proper. In any manner they think proper. Take the initiative process away, and I think changing the government gets a lot more spectacular and probably makes the evening news reels. So the initiative process is a way of people having civil recourse to alter, change, or even abolish their government. So Greg Wasson has made a strong case about the government, I've seen him do it before, he didn't do it today, about the government imposing rules that have absolutely eroded our constitutional rights. The Constitution says that initiatives are to be voted on at general elections. The Constitution does not say that general elections are every second November. It doesn't say that. And in fact, that is a convenient interpretation by the Attorney General's office. The Constitution also does not say, you are given a timeline, and it's reasonable to have a timeline to turn in signatures before an election. The Constitution does say that. The Constitution does not say, though, that if you miss the deadline, your signatures are dead. But the Attorney General has decided that they're dead. So there, we have enough of examples of the government going against the initiative process, against the people's process, in which Article 4 says the people have reserved to themselves the right of initiative and referendum, and it really was to get after the scallywags in the legislature at the turn of the century, because the railroads and the corporations were really dominating things. That's why it came about. Still could be one of the explanations for the initiative and referendum process. So it seems to me that if you're going to talk about reform, one of the things that always comes out of here is that well, maybe the signature requirement isn't tough enough. So there will be movements to make it a lot tougher, and in the meantime, squeezing us from the other side. And I'm just saying, if you're doing your job carefully and ethically, making reforms that only enhances the power of the elected government against the primary legislature of the people is not right, and it is, and it's, I think it's against the constitutional intent. So I don't know if there's going to be more discussions about all of this, but I would certainly love to weigh in with some written ideas, if you'll take them under advisement.
Well, what I would appreciate you doing is doing just that. If you could submit some written testimony just for us. What we're trying to do is just get it. You know, and really, quite honestly, the things that I think are very saleable are making the process a little less cumbersome, less expensive, simpler, cleaner. So we get everything done that we need to do. I think that's the kind of stuff that I'd like us to be able to put on the table.
Okay, well, we'll be there. But I mean, the one bill filed that has real visibility is the one I saw was Senator Courtney's bill. That is, you want to talk about something that would have a chilling effect on the process. I think it was there's a suggest that chief petitioners would be liable for $100,000 fine and time in jail if something goes haywire, if they knowingly allow some person to sign twice. Just a threat of a lawyer coming after you like that, and that would happen. Your opponents would do it big time. I don't think that's the direction we want to go.
And maybe if you could provide, to the committee what in writing with some of these things for our consideration.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for allowing us to speak.
Thank you. Senator Burdick, did you need to want to talk?
Oh, no, thank you.
Okay. Tim Nisbet.
Thank you, Chair Harper, and members of the committee. I actually have bulleted points for you.
What a guy.
Just what you asked for.
What a guy.
And I'll be brief since I'm submitting at least an outline of my comments. I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and have been involved in the initiative process both as a proponent and opponent of initiatives for the last four election cycles. My comments today are limited to what I believe are flaws in our state's statutory system for processing and presenting initiatives to the voters and for monitoring and disclosing the financing of initiative campaigns, rather than the constitutional rights for the initiative and referendum, which I do not address nor do I propose changing. Basically, the fundamental problem with the statutory framework we have now is that it's unnecessarily expensive. You heard about the number of cases in terms of ballot title challenges that have been generated in the last several years. It's administratively burdensome, and we believe it gives inappropriate control over final ballot language to initiative practitioners. Now, as Mr. Sizemore explained, or perhaps he didn't cover this part, it only takes 25 signatures to set in motion this whole elaborate process of the AG's office drafting a ballot title, sending it out for comments coming in, a new title being drafted, a final title being issued, appeals being filed to the Supreme Court, and then finally, at some point, a resolution after argument before the court of an appropriate ballot title. That process was initiated for over 160 measures in the last election cycle. And for over 90 of them, it went all the way to the Supreme Court. But I believe fewer than 20 of those, if you look at those that made the ballot last time that were not referred by the legislature or were not themselves referenda, fewer than 20 of those eventually made it to the ballot. And I think only one or two additionally fell just short of getting the signatures. There were fewer than 25 serious initiatives out on the streets in the last cycle. But the court dealt with over 90. The Secretary of State and the AG dealt with over 160. And that's what's wrong with this process, is that it's too easy. I could have, in the time I've been sitting here waiting to testify, had written down an idea on a piece of paper, gotten 25 signatures, and ran it over to the Secretary of State's office by 5 o'clock today, and the wheels would start moving, and the expenses would accrue. And it's not necessary that I've shown you I have a serious idea because I've only gotten 25 signatures on a piece of paper. We believe there needs to be a more significant showing of interest and support from the voters before we set that process in motion. And there are a number of ways for doing that. But basically we're saying this system is too front-end loaded, front-end heavy, front-end expensive. And no other state that we know of does it this way. Now, it leads to ballot title shopping. You've heard previous presenters talk about how important the ballot title is. Just a story in my discussions with Mr. Sizemore over the years. What ended up on the ballot last election is Measure 91 started out, I think, in about 4 or 5 different iterations. I commented on his first one, and Mr. Sizemore realized he had made a mistake, so he redrafted it. He commented on the second one, he redrafted that. Redrafted and refiled the third and fourth and fifth time, I believe. He eventually went to the ballot with a version of Measure 91, which would have reduced not just personal income taxes, but corporate income taxes. But told me in a private conversation that he chose the one he went to the ballot with, not because he liked the corporate income tax piece, because he liked the title better. So now we've come all the way to the point where ballot titles, the ballot titling process, is driving policy. And Mr. Sizemore put Measure 91 on the ballot in the version in which it appeared, not because he thought it was the better proposal, but because it had the better title and it polled better. We submit the process we have now leads to unnecessary and expensive administrative costs and sometimes very frivolous proposals. And frivolous ballot title challenges. Just as it's so easy now to abuse a system by filing and refiling to get the title you like, it's very easy to block the system by appealing every title you don't like to the courts. That's why we had over 90 of those. That explains why we had over 90 of those appeals to the courts in the last cycle. And it leads to another phenomenon, what I call ballot title marketing. In Oregon, if you're a practitioner of the initiative process, and you draft and redraft, and eventually you get it right, and if you resubmit your 25 signatures, get enough comments, people kind of rehabilitate your measure for you because you've been getting it wrong, but finally with enough comments, you get it right, and you get a ballot title you like with 25 signatures, you own that ballot title. You market that ballot title. You poll on it. You see what tests better, and then you go out and you raise money on it. And in some cases, you trade it away to other people because you got too many to get to handle in one election. That's inappropriate. Ballot title ought to be what the name suggests, a ballot title. When you qualify for the ballot, you earn the title. And that takes the 89,000 signatures or so that's required under our Constitution. We believe the way to fix the process is to require a much more significant showing of interest, if not the full number of signatures required before you generate the ballot title process. If that's too back-end heavy administratively, then set a bar that establishes a reasonable threshold to show you got enough voters out there, enough citizens out there signing your petition to indicate this is serious enough to put the wheels in motion to get a ballot title. That could be set at 50% of the signatures just as easily as it could be set at 100%. That would, we think, correct these abuses that have arisen over how people manipulate this front-end loaded system that we have and make a ballot title a serious title that you get when you've shown enough interest. In the meantime, you can have a circulating title that adequately suggests what the measure says, carries that number in the upper right-hand corner of the petition, so a voter knows what he or she is signing, when signing a petition, and the Secretary of State knows that those signatures match up to that proposal.
So essentially, the initial entry
yes.
Bars.
Yes. Yeah. There's an analogy in our workplaces. In order to get an election for union representation, you need a showing of interest on a petition of at least 30% of the workers. Otherwise, you don't bother to put the machinery in place. Similarly here, you ought to have a serious showing of interest before you put the gears in motion, generate all the cost and all the comment. And by the way, these public comment periods that arise after that initial title is issued are quite important. If there's a measure being filed, then it would have a particular impact that you or your organization don't like, and you fail to comment, you're out of luck and you can't even take that to the Supreme Court. That may be 14 or 18 months ahead of when it may get on the ballot, and way in advance of when anybody's paying attention to what might be on the ballot. So we think it makes for a better process in terms of public comment to kind of set a bar where you get more serious qualification, and then a fewer number and people are paying attention. This is something that has support. I better look at this title. I better comment on it if it affects me or my organization or my members. And right now, too many of them fly through. I've done it. In the last election cycle, I think I was chief petitioner on about 12 different measures, none of which we decided to take to the ballot. A couple of which our opponents failed to comment on. We said, oh boy, guess what? We got a great title. They didn't comment. They can't challenge us to the court. But they challenged us on another three or four versions of it. They just happened to miss one. That happened with Measure 7. Nobody commented on the title. Big dispute now whether that title was an accurate title. Nobody commented. Nobody could challenge. That's not a fair process.
Okay.
Secondly, when you think of it, we've been having a constitutional convention on our ballot every 2 years in Oregon for many election cycles. It's getting more and more lengthy in terms of the number of proposals. And not all voters are quite aware of that. We had 26 measures on the ballot last November. I don't know if any of you know how many of those were constitutional. 17. And those, we believe, require separate scrutiny and more serious deliberation than the statutory initiatives. They're a more serious change. The only thing now that highlights that change for the voters are two words at the front, amends constitution. But most voters are thinking of Measure 91, Measure 93, Measure 96. They're not thinking of which one of the constitutional amendments. In many states, when voters are presented with initiatives, they separately see the statutory initiatives. In our case, it might have been Measures 83 through 90. And then they separately see the constitutional amendments. In our case, it might have been constitutional amendments A through F. It makes a difference. Your attention is called. It's a little more deliberation, a little more pause, a little more consideration given when you're making that weighty decision about whether to vote to change your constitution. Very simple change. Can be done statutorily. We think the voters will be better informed by separately presenting constitutional amendments. And finally, we strongly support the idea of disclosing who is funding signature-gathering campaigns while those campaigns are going on. This is a process every bit as serious now as your own legislative process. And just as you have concern about whether it's appropriate to even give contributions during legislative session, you definitely want to make sure you know who's giving. And the same ought to apply at every phase of the initiative process, as serious as it is for public policy in our state. But the public has a right to know, and those who care will find out, and they'll pay attention.
Secretary of State, same proposal that we heard from there.
Yes, although I would point out to you that Measure 62, which we supported in 1998, which passed with 68% of the vote, has since been overturned by the courts because of the multiple subject interpretation of the Armada standard in our Constitution. It contained provisions in there for monthly reporting of financing, of who's funding initiative campaigns. Now, we believe that just as happened with other measures that were approved by the voters, but then stricken down by the courts because of the multiple subject requirement, that piece ought to be taken out and looked at, and that can be adopted statutorily. It doesn't need to be done constitutionally. Just do what the voters already asked you to have done in Measure 62 and require monthly reporting of who's funding initiative campaigns during the signature gathering phase. Those are the simplest ideas we have. They can all be done statutorily. We think they make a lot of sense, and we hope you'll consider them.
Thank you very much. Question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Richard Burke.
I'll throw this microphone over here.
Mm-hmm. We've had a request from the recorder to please stay 4 to 6 inches away from the mic.
Okay. Is this good?
We need a ruler.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, my name is Richard Burke, for the record. I'm the legislative assistant, or one of them, for Senator Gary George. And I have a few comments here of a more general nature. And that is, I have not gotten any phone calls from any constituents saying that they are unhappy with the constituent initiative process. And I also took part in a statewide campaign, traveled across the state during the election, and heard virtually no complaints. I do hear some complaining about the length of the voter's pamphlet, but it's kind of a proud kind of complaining, like when your grandfather would say, I used to walk through 12 feet of snow to get to school every day, or someone from Minnesota says, I got through this winter. I think that when they do complain, there is some pride in that Oregonians do go through that process. And this is actually borne out by the selective nature in which Oregonians have chosen to pass these ballot measures. So, you know, there's a saying that I think we've all heard, only Nixon could go to China. Likewise, I think any changes to the initiative process which would impede it, slow it down, delay it, whatever, would have to come from the citizens, not the legislature. You know, take a look here, and I see, you know, Lloyd Marbette, who is sort of perceived to be on the left side of the political spectrum, got Don McIntyre here, and these people always come together when there are proposals from the legislature to put roadblocks in or delays into the initiative process. And that's because of what others have said before me, that it isn't because there's any evil lurking, but it's the nature of the legislature to try and expand its power at the expense of the initiative process. So I think anything that comes out of the legislature is going to inherently be viewed with suspicion by those who value and look at the initiative process. So I would say that if you find ways to make things go more quickly, make them run more cheaply, more efficiently, I think that a lot of Oregonians would welcome that. But I think anything the legislature might do which is perceived to slow down the system or take away power of the citizenry, I think is going to meet opposition all across the political spectrum, as evidenced by the people you see in this room, and is going to be knocked down. And the image of the legislature will be sullied, which is, I think, something that no one wants, including most of the Oregonians that vote on these measures. So these are just my concepts that I offer to you. I'm not as experienced as Bill Sizemore or Lloyd Marbette or Don McIntyre, so I can't offer you as many technical suggestions, but I just wanted to sort of take that conceptual framework to say that any such changes should come from the citizens, not the legislature. Thank you very much.
So you don't have anything for us to consider?
Well, except to bear in mind that anything that comes out of the legislature, which would impede the initiative process itself, is inherently going to be viewed with suspicion by those who value it.
You guys are so suspicious. I was just asking questions. Golly, Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I can't help but comment, and while I think you may be on point, the process that you're defending is one that a legislature in the past established.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who set the rules.
Well, I, Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, I don't mean to make a disparaging remark about past legislatures, but they say even a broken clock is right twice a day. So so maybe this is one of those times.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions?
That's it. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's all we had signed up. Let's see. Steve Novick? The other sign-up sheet. Sorry. Keith Garza here. Okay, you're on the list. And Kathy, those are three that I
have to go in about 10 minutes.
Okay, well, you come on now. Hub, you got a few minutes? Let Kathy come up first. Yeah.
Thank you, appreciate that.
That's all I had signed up, so anybody else, raise your hand and we'll get to the end.
I have a list for you.
Senator Hopper, members of the committee that remain. For the record, I'm Kathy Eaton. I'm the government chair of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. In 1997-98, the League studied extensively the initiative process in Oregon. And we have come, during that discussion, we came up with a possible 11 changes that we're pointing out to you today. Six of them are statutory, Five of them are constitutional amendments. You've heard of some of them already. I'm not going to flesh them out. I'm simply going to list them for you so that you have it for the record. Certainly, the number of signatures needed to file a prospective, the prescriptive petition needs to be raised. Our members discussed anywhere from 1,000 to 5,000. Using a percentage of the number of signatures that's required for the particular initiative, whether it's statute or constitutional, is a possible guideline for doing that. Secondly, there must be some kind of a review of the proposed initiatives for drafting errors and possible illegal areas. The litigation cost to the state, as well as the cost of time and resources to the legislature when they're trying to implement initiatives that are passed, and the language is so poorly drafted that it's almost impossible to do that. If there was some kind of review that's done prior to, we believe, prior to the initial circulation of the petition. Secondly, thirdly, we'd like to suggest that there be some kind of an advisory opinion as to the constitutionality of each petition after it has qualified. We know the Supreme Court has refused to do that, but there are other options for having that kind of constitutional review. Certainly, the time frame for collecting signatures, we believe, should be limited, and limited to 12 months. The voter's pamphlet, contrary to some of the things we've heard today, isn't that popularly conceived as being a bedtime reading. People do depend on it for... well, that's what I'm saying. But it is a very important publication, and a lot of people use it to try to glean the information that they need, particularly this last time with 26 ballot measures and people trying to understand it. Other states that have a lot of initiatives, such as California, have gone to different ways for their publication, and they don't allow every possible argument pro and con. They limit arguments pro and con. Montana has an interesting system. I can talk with you later about what that can do, but we simply think you do need to look at limiting the pro and con arguments, and there are ways of doing that without impinging on the public's right to know. And finally, as the sixth statute, we believe that the restrictions and penalties for signature gathering fraud need to be tightened. As far as amending the Constitution to change the process, we believe that it should require more than a simple majority of votes cast to pass a constitutional amendment initiative. We've only amended our federal constitution less than 30 times in over 200 years. That's because it takes 3/4 of the states to pass those constitutional amendments. I think it's time for us to consider what kind of threshold there should be to put something into our constitution. We believe that there are some needed exemptions in terms of what can be provided by constitutional amendment initiatives. The Bill of Rights should be exempted from initiative amendment, and revenue measures should be exempted. Most of the other 26 states, 25 states, which allow initiatives, have some kind of limitation. Some of them, in fact, don't even allow constitutional amendment initiatives, but those which do, most of them have some restriction in terms of the Bill of Rights or of revenue measures. We believe that it's time to look seriously at the indirect initiative as an alternative. The indirect initiative is where, after an initiative is qualified for the ballot, it goes to the legislature for their next session. I believe that there's a bill now that is talking about that particular way as an option. It makes sense, particularly in certain kinds of initiatives. And finally, we do support a 2-year moratorium on legislative revision of an adopted initiative, except to clarify the implementation of it and to correct errors in form and style. And we'd be happy to talk with you about specifics within that list. But that's what you asked for, was a list.
That's got it. Super. Better everything. Thank you very much. Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee. My name is Steve Novick, and I'm the director of the Center for Constructive Citizen Action, which is an entity, a nonprofit entity, which monitors initiative filings, frequently submits comments to the Attorney General's draft titles, and frequently assists in the drafting of initiatives, and has been engaged in numerous Supreme Court challenges to initiative to ballot titles. I'd like to begin with a preliminary observation responding in part to Mr. Burke's comments, which is, although the initiative process is popular and vital, and I doubt that very much that the voters would accept drastic new restrictions on the process, the public last fall rejected Measure 96 by a margin of better than 60-40. Measure 96 would have prohibited the legislature from taking any action which makes the initiative process more difficult or expensive. And the voters soundly rejected that measure, thus indicating to me that the public would not object to the legislature's making modest statutory changes to the process to address abuses, make the process less costly, and provide the voters with better information. As an active participant in the initiative process, I'd like to reiterate what some folks have said about the phenomenon of ballot title shopping. As Mr. Nesbitt pointed out, you can get a ballot title by submitting 25 sponsorship signatures. You can go around in an afternoon, get 25 signatures. Actually, in a moment of humor, I once heard Mr. Sizemore said, everybody knows you can forge 25 signatures in a couple of hours. You can...
You got caught though, didn't you?
Well, he personally, I don't think, forged. But you can get a ballot title but with 25 signatures. Now, what this does is invite a practice which some of us would think is abusive, the practice of ballot title shopping. And by that, I don't mean only filing numerous versions of the same initiative, but filing a whole bunch of initiatives that serve the general interest of some interest group in the hope that you get a fun ballot title. I mean, I think we all have sort of an idealized version of what the initiative process should be. You've got an issue that's the subject of considerable public discussion. The legislature hasn't moved on it. You've got a proposal to address that issue that has considerable public support. A bunch of interested citizens bring that proposal to the ballot. But in the system we have now, you can also have an alternate scenario. You have an intelligent practitioner of the initiative process who has access to people with money, who have some general ideological interests. Suppose you have somebody who has connections with Democratic donors, who would have an interest in hurting industries that normally support Republicans. Such a practitioner can sit down, draft 10 different initiatives that are designed to attack Republican donors, and get two ballot titles that, at first glance, most voters, even if they never thought about the issue before, would probably say, sure, sounds good. And then that practitioner can take those ballot titles to that group of Democratic donors and say, hey, you pay me to get this on the ballot, and I'll undermine your enemies. Similarly, you can have somebody who has access to a group of donors who, in general, don't like the government or don't like unions. And such a practitioner can file 60 different measures on, you know, three different versions of 20 different measures attacking the government or unions. It doesn't really matter how. And it doesn't matter whether that the issues addressed by those proposed initiatives have received much public discussion or concern. And you get a few ballot titles that look good, and you go to these donor people who you know will fund measures generally of that sort and say, hey, I've got ballot titles for you. Pay me to put them on the ballot. The system that we have now invites that type of behavior. In fact, frankly, I'm surprised there's not more of it than we've seen today. I'm surprised that instead of 160 filings with the Secretary of State to get ballot titles in the 2000 election cycle, we didn't have 1,000. And I think that it's quite possible that in some future election cycle, we will have 1,000. And I think that there has got to be something that we can do to crack down on that practice. I think the people who are truly committed to bringing forward a policy idea to the voters, an idea that they are specifically committed to, will not object to collecting all of the signatures necessary to qualify, or at least a significant portion of the signatures necessary to qualify, in order to start this ballot title process rolling. If people are really committed to an idea, I think they'll be willing to do that. And I think that they should have to do that before we start a process which involves the time of the money of the taxpayers and the time and energy of the Supreme Court and the Attorney General. And I think that, you know, one option would be to postpone the ballot title process until you have all your signatures. You could postpone the ballot title process until you have 30% of your signatures. But 25 signatures is an invitation to disaster.
Yes, just a thought, Steve. Under your concept of doing that, whatever that number was, would that first 500 or 1,000 signatures apply towards the 89?
Absolutely. I think that if you're going to demand a certain number of signatures, a significant number of signatures in order to start the ballot title process, those signatures should count towards the final number you need to qualify. And as I believe Mr. Schwedel mentioned, one suggestion has been made is that at the front end, rather than elaborate ballot title process, you have a process which generates a different piece of writing by the Attorney General, call it a measure summary for circulation, which doesn't look like a ballot title but generally describes the measure, and that's put on the petition sheets that people go out to collect signatures on. By the way, I'd like to briefly address some of the committee members' questions about whether it makes sense to have a ballot title at all that's drafted by the Attorney General and reviewed by the Supreme Court, and I would submit as a practitioner that it does. The voter should have an objective, a description of the measure written by an objective party, and I think that to have a description that's written by the proponents of a measure would be just as subject, as Mr. Sizemore himself acknowledged, to abuse as a system where you have the ballot title written by the leading opponents of the measure, whoever that might be. And I also would say that if you had a system where the proponents and opponents offered competing titles and some neutral arbiter picked one, that would essentially mean that whichever side had the smartest lawyer would end up with their ballot title. And although I tend to think I'm a pretty smart lawyer and I bet I would win some of those fights, I don't think that's a good way to set public policy. I'd like to pick up on a term that Mr. Sizemore used. He said that the ballot title is, in effect, a polling question. And I think that's a very accurate description. I think it's unavoidable. And I think that the way we have a process now which is set up so that there's people who aren't particularly interested in pushing a specific policy idea. They're interested in finding a ballot title which will serve as a polling question to which the answer will generally be yes. And if that polling question measure serves the interests of some interest group that's willing to pay for it on the ballot, then you go ahead with it. I'd also like to briefly comment on the fact that I think that the current ballot title, this law, is set up so that ballot titles themselves are biased in favor of people who put proposals in the ballot either to spend more money on some popular public service or to cut taxes. And the reason for that is this. The captions, according to the ballot title law, the caption, you know, is the all bold capital letters part of the title that we can be fairly certain most people read, they're supposed to describe the subject matter of the measure. And the way the Attorney General and the courts have read that, they say, it basically describes the legal operation of the measure, and the captions are not supposed to say what the effect of the measure will be. When you're talking about measures which either will cost money or which will cut taxes, the effect of that is you end up with ballot titles that are sort of inherently biased in favor of a yes vote for the measure. And I'd like to give a couple of recent examples. With Measure 66 in 1998, proposing to dedicate lottery money to parks and salmon, the caption said, dedicate some lottery funding to parks, comma, beaches, semicolon, habitat, watershed protection. And the caption did not alert voters that the effect of that is you have less money available for education and economic development, which I think is a significant fact that people should be alerted to, should have been alerted to. When Mr. Sizemore proposed Measure 91 in the 2000 election, the caption said, makes federal income taxes fully deductible in Oregon tax returns. The caption did not explain that would mean less money would be available for education, public safety, health care, etc. And I would submit that...
You really believe this? You didn't say that people can't understand that there's a correlation between income and expense?
I believe, but, Mr. Chair, obviously people do understand there's a correlation between income and expense, but voters don't always necessarily have a good idea of what services are paid for by which revenue source, for instance. Mm-hmm. And there's polling that shows that. And there's also simply the phenomenon, and it doesn't mean that people are stupid or hypocritical, it's just sort of a natural human phenomenon that, as Mr. Sizemore said, the way you phrase a polling question affects how people react to it.
Interesting.
And you know that if you go out and you ask people, should we provide universal health care, then you're going to get an phrase the question that way, then you're going to get a larger percentage of positive responses than if you said, should we provide universal health care, even if that means higher taxes or less money for other services?
Yeah. Okay.
That's all I have for the committee today, and I really appreciate your indulgence in hearing all of us.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for giving your time to Kathy. I appreciate that. Bill Ferry.
Thank you. Thanks. To the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Association. I was going to actually start with one point that Mr. Novak added at the end, and I would even, his ballot title, I wouldn't even change it that much on the one where would you agree to universal health care, and you just changed it to would you believe in a mandate in health care. One word change, I think, would swing your polling 20%, and that's kind of where the ballot title shopping comes from. I wouldn't guarantee that, but I bet I'm pretty close. But I want to talk to you because I'm actually probably one of the few people in this room that has never tried to put anything on the ballot. I've been the target of several ballot measures, but I have not ever tried to put anything on the ballot, even though, as Mr. Novak has said, I have proposed a few, in his words, modest statutory changes to some ballot measures. But as you look at the ballot measure process in the last 2 years, I would say that our system of government is set up to be representative because they want people to come here and compromise. The two kinds of ballot measures that have been put on, from my perspective, has either been somebody who is unwilling to compromise at the legislative level and think they have a better chance in the populist level, or they're punitive in nature. They are either going after a certain group or, trying to drain money, as people have said. So I just think there's, knowing that those are the goals of the people that are participating in the process today, even though they may not admit it, I think you have kind of two things from my perspective that have to be done. Number one, ballot titles is the issue that's being dealt with. Let's face it, the yes and no statements, people don't read. The text of the measures, people don't read. A lot of them don't read their voter's pamphlet. They read the ballot title. So I would say, from my perspective, you have to make the ballot title longer and more descriptive. They can argue, but if they're not going to read the text of the measure, and these things are having such a drastic effect on people, the more you can explain on what it does, I think the better you have the opportunity of explaining to the general public what happens in the ballot measure. So I would say make it a little bit longer. Not that I like to read that much either, but I think it would add to it. And the second, I think it would eliminate a majority of the people that are participating in the process today from a standpoint of it no longer becomes punitive in nature. Is, I think it's Washington, I don't know, but I've heard of a system that says what you do is you take the ballot title, that if you took my model, extended it a little bit and took a description, and you would say, we want the legislative body to deal with this issue. So you no longer put exactly verbatim what people write in their statute. You would say the legislative body has to deal with the ballot title issue. I know everybody's going to come unglued that participates in this process, but the people that are unwilling to compromise no longer have a reason to go after the ballot measure because they're not going to get their extreme measure, and it no longer always becomes punitive because you can find a way, I think, to deal with the extremes on both sides. So you still have the public process of them saying, we want this issue to be dealt with, but you eliminate the punitive and descriptive natures of the ballot measures. And since it's late and I like to pride myself on being brief, I will end with that, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Bill, your last point. So your idea would be that it would just be just a directive to the legislature to deal with the issue?
Yeah. Chairman Harper, Representative, Senator Beyer, yeah, I would say that what you do is you say, I'd say, I want tax cuts, I want personal income tax cuts. You no longer set the rate, you would say, we just want lower taxes, which is what I think a lot of people feel that they are, but then you set specific tax rates or certain tax rates, and all of a sudden you get into, it can cause extreme damages. That's probably not the best example to use, but I would say, a majority of the people in Oregon want lower taxes. Do they understand, because, most of the people in this building don't understand how the budget process works. I don't mean that to be negative, but it's a complex project. So if I want lower personal income tax rates, that would be a directive, and then they can find out in the next election cycle whether they felt the legislature did an accurate job of carrying out their mission.
Another cool idea.
I've got lots of great ideas. How many times have I tried?
But you have a notepad. It's a pen.
You won't be able to read my writing.
Thank you.
Leave enough for you?
Yes. Good.
Anybody else? Free. Okay. With that, we're adjourned.